that. And as for economic coercion, the West has had hundreds of years to build infrastructure in Africa, in Latin America, and in Asia, and they just haven't done it. For example, the UK has had at least 100 years, but China has been able to build the high-speed trains. So it is basically the West crying that China is being able to compete in the marketplace they created.
Thank you very much. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time, Isha. Krishnaswamy, their podcaster and journalist from St. Petersburg. Thank you. Joyce Samiali, a pleasure. Senior Research Fellow, Global Policy Institute, London Metropolitan University from Budapest. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tawai and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 218 to 219. From the chapter Al-Baqarah from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parhizgar.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Innal ladhina amanu wal ladhina hajaru wa jahadu fi sabilillah. إِنَّ الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَالَّذِينَ هَاجَرُوا وَجَاهَدُوا فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ أُولَئِكَ يَرْجُونَ رَحْمَةَ اللَّهِ أُولَئِكَ يَرْجُونَ رَحْمَةَ اللَّهِ وَاللَّهُ غَفُورٌ رَحِيمٌ يَسْأَلُونَكَ عَنِ الْخَمْرِ وَالْمَيْسِرِ قُلْ فِيهِمَا إِثْمٌ كبير ومنافع للناس قل فيهما إثم كبير ومنافع للناس وإثمهما أكبر من نفعه بهما ويسألونك ماذا ينفقون قل العفو وكذلك يبين الله لكم الآيات لعلكم تتفكرون ويسألونك ماذا ينفقون قل العفو كذلك يبين الله لكم الآيات لعلكم تتفكرون.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Surely those who believed and those who fled their home and strove hard in the way of Allah, these hope for the mercy of Allah, and Allah is forgiving, merciful. They ask you about intoxicants and games of chance. Say, in both of them there is a great sin and means of profit for men, and their sin is greater than their profit. And they ask you as to what they should spend. Say, what you can spare. Thus does Allah make clear to you the communications that you may ponder.
Israeli forces killed three young Palestinians in a raid on a refugee camp near the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. Russia warns the West against sending F-16 fighter jets to Ukraine, saying that it would raise the question of NATO's direct involvement in the war. And Beijing warns London to stop slandering and smearing China to avoid further damage to the two countries' relations. Thanks for joining us. Israeli forces have fatally shot three Palestinian men in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. The young Palestinians were shot during a raid on the Balata camp east of Nablus. A public mourning has been declared in the city for the three men. Israeli forces also injured at least 65 Palestinians, three of them critically. Hamas resistance movement now says Israeli crimes will not affect Palestinians' will to fight the regime and to support the Al-Aqsa Mosque. The movement says Palestinian sanctities are red lines that Israel should not cross. The regime has stepped up its crackdown against Palestinians since the formation of a new far-right cabinet under Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu late last year. This year alone, Israeli forces have killed over 140 Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. Earlier we talked to Mona Kandil to get more details on the deadly Israeli raid. Here's what she had to say.
The raid this morning, or even before dawn, to Balata refugee camp in Nablus was described as one of the largest operations in years. Clashes took place between the Palestinian fighters and the residents of the refugee camp of Balata and Israeli forces, who blockaded all the entrances after or during the incursion to Balata refugee camp. A number of Palestinians had been wounded as well, according to Palestinian paramedics, including some were shot by live fire, others suffocated due to inhaling tear gas, some were shot even by rubber-coated bullets, according to the Palestinian paramedics. This incursion to Balata refugee camp came at the same time when the Israeli forces raided the eastern area of Annapolis.
The barrage of condemnations is coming in after a far-right Israeli minister visited the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in a violation of the holy site status quo. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman denounced the move, calling it a provocative step by an extremist member of the Israeli apartheid regime. Nasser Kanani called for urgent measures by the international community to prevent such crimes. Earlier, the Arab League slammed the move as a dangerous escalation, warning of an uncontrollable religious conflict. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas also described the raid as barbaric. The U.S. also weighed in. Washington called the visit provocative, saying the holy site should not be used for political purposes. The Sunday visit by the cabinet minister Itamar Ben-Gvir was his second since he took office. He also claimed that Israel owns the compound. Palestinians pushed back against the comments, saying such rhetoric does not change the status quo of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. The Iraqi national team withdraws from the World Fencing Championship in Turkey after finding out that they would be competing against Israel. In a statement, the Iraqi Fencing Federation said the decision was made, quote, in rejection of the occupying Israeli entity and in solidarity with the Palestinian cause. The move also complies with the legislation passed by the Iraqi parliament in May 2020, criminalizing normalization with the regime. On Friday, a Kuwaiti fencer also withdrew from the games in Turkey to avoid facing an Israeli contestant. Fencer said that he made the decision to express support for the Palestinian cause and refusal of normalization with Israel. The Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah has conducted a military drill in southern Lebanon. As our correspondent Mariam Saleh reports, the drill simulated an operation repelling an Israeli invasion of Lebanon back in the year 2000.
To commemorate the 23rd anniversary of the liberation of South Lebanon from Israeli occupation, Hezbollah conducted an unprecedented live military drill in the South Lebanese town of Aramta. After a show of hand-to-hand combat and a parade of all-terrain vehicles and motorcycles, the fighters launched a simulation of taking over an Israeli post in the occupied Galilee area. Over 100 media outlets covered the event, which many say is something unseen since before the liberation in 2000.
The location chosen for this is quite telling. First of all, it's close to the border with Israel. And, of course, this area back in before 2000 was under Israeli occupation. The old Bir Kalab outpost the Israelis had was just up on the hill behind us. So this is very familiar territory for Hezbollah.
The head of Hezbollah's executive council, Sayed Hashem Safieddine, warned Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that his cabinet will not be able to change the rules of engagement.
Our message to Israel is clear. If you think that you can launch a full-scale aggression in order to strike the equations of deterrence, which we made with our blood and armaments and strength, we will be ready to shower you with precise rockets, and you will witness black days unlike any other. The Israeli regime knows what we mean. We will use our precise rockets and all means available to us.
Observers see that Hezbollah is primarily seeking psychological warfare against Israel with this maneuver.
But clearly the message is towards the Israelis primarily. As we've seen with the recent escalation in Gaza, we've seen a tightening of the ties, the military ties between Hezbollah, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and so on. So I think this show today feeds into that.
Hezbollah says the drill sent a message to the Israeli regime about the readiness of the resistance to deter enemy aggression and defend Lebanon. Israeli forces left most of southern Lebanon on May 25, 2000, after 22 years of occupation. Hezbollah's military drill is not merely a show of force, with prospects of a possible confrontation and continuous Israeli aggressions towards Al-Quds. Hezbollah wants to send a clear message to the Israelis that its deterrence capabilities remain intact. Mariam Saleh, South Lebanon.
An official ceremony has been held in the southern Iranian port city of Bandar Abbas to welcome the arrival of a naval flotilla back home after a successful journey around the world. The ceremony was attended by top military commanders, including the Chief of General Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces. Major General Mohammad Baghdadi said at the ceremony that the expedition marks the beginning of a new chapter in the growth of Iran's naval power. The general added that the mission is a unique achievement for a navy, which has been subjected to sanctions and other propaganda and pressure. Flotilla comprised the domestically manufactured Dana destroyer and the Macron forward-based ship. They entered Iranian waters on May 17. The flotilla completed a 63,000-kilometer journey around the Earth in 8 months.
It marked the first time that an Iranian naval group entered the Pacific. The vessels sailed to South America and visited South Africa before returning home. The correspondent Gisu Misha Ahmadi asked the chief of the staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Bagheri, about the U.S. pressure campaign against the flotilla. This is what he had to say.
Tell us about the U.S. The U.S. had threatened countries, had asked countries not to allow the Iranian flotilla, the Iranian warships, to dock in their countries. However, we saw that despite U.S. threats, countries like Brazil did not heed the U.S. threats, and also some sanctions had been imposed on this flotilla. The eight-month voyage by this flotilla around the world showed that we can, with reliance on our own capabilities, we can be present in any place in the world, in the oceans around the world, wherever the maritime law allows us to. So we docked at five ports during this voyage. The U.S. tried to threaten those countries and ask them not to allow the Iranian warships to dock there, but it didn't happen, and the U.S. should accept that the leverage that it shows, that it uses in the world, those levers are losing their power, are waning, and countries are trying to remain independent, and countries want to decide about their own future. You are seeing these developments in countries in the southern part of the Persian Gulf, and our flotilla, you saw that docked in those countries. U.S. threats are, in fact, threadbare threats. They are saying that they have just kept themselves alive by making these threats. They want to create the impression that they are the masters of the world, and the U.S. wants just to create the impression that it remains a master and a world power.
Russia has renewed its warning to the West about supplying F-16 fighter jets to Ukraine. Moscow says providing Kiev with the warplanes would bring up the question of NATO's involvement in the ongoing conflict. The Russian ambassador to Washington sounded the alarm that the advanced American fighter jets may end up bombing targets belonging to Russia. Anatoly Antonov pointed to Russian-controlled Crimea, where Kiev has stepped up his attacks. Antonov said any Ukrainian strike on Crimea would be regarded as a strike on Russia. On Saturday, Moscow cautioned that Western countries would suffer colossal risks if they offer the warplanes to Ukraine. That after the U.S. gave a green light to its allies to supply Kiev with fighter jets and allow training programs for Ukrainian pilots. Washington had for months expressed its reluctance to send warplanes to Kiev, citing numerous reasons. The Chinese embassy in London has asked the British government to stop slandering and smearing campaign to avoid further damage to China-UK relations. The call was issued after the British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak said following a G7 summit in Japan that China represents the world's greatest challenge to security and prosperity. In a statement on Sunday, the Chinese embassy denounced his remarks as a rehash of words by leaders of other bloc members. The embassy noted that Sunak's comments constitute malicious slanders in disregard of the facts on the ground. It added that China firmly opposes and strongly condemns the remarks. In France, people have once again taken to the streets to show their anger at the government's pension reforms. The protesters marched toward Cannes, but police blocked roads leading to the city center. This is the French Riviera has banned demonstrations near an ongoing film festival there. For months, the country has been the scene of strikes and demonstrations against the government's pension reform bill, which was recently signed into law by President Emmanuel Macron. As part of the reforms, the retirement age will rise from 62 to 64. French union members have called for another protest on May 23. Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis says his conservative party unleashed a, quote, political earthquake with a thumping victory in Sunday's parliamentary elections. Mitsotakis said, however, that he would seek a new ballot to enable his party to secure an absolute majority to govern alone. With just over 82% of the votes counted, New Democracy Party was in a commanding lead of nearly 41%. Radical leftist Syriza Party of Alexis Tsipras was trailing far behind, with just over 20% of the ballots. Despite the clear win, the conservatives were short of a few seats for an outright majority, meaning that Mitsotakis would either form a coalition government or opt for a new ballot to get a decisive result. Political analyst Stavros Mavridis says the Greek election results have been a big loss for the pro-Western opposition party.
The results as of the moment are at around 50%, which is a big percentage. So a clear lead of the right-wing party, the incumbent in government, right-wing party, New Democracy. And Syriza trailing far behind. This is a blatant failure of Syriza. Syriza, you said in the beginning it's a leftist party. It's not actually a leftist party. It has moved to the center. It has become a docile opposition, seeking the favor of the U.S., the EU, and even the Israelis, and, of course, the Greek oligarchs. It was unable, but also unwilling, to organize popular struggles that erupted against the right-wing government. So for this reason, Syriza is failing utterly, and this will probably create contradictions and conflicts within the Syriza party.
Concerns are on the rise in Afghanistan over the high level of poverty, with children withstanding the worst of its consequences. As Abdullah Mirzada reports from Kabul, many children are working to take a morsel home while facing malnutrition and exclusion from school.
UNICEF representative for Afghanistan says some 90% of the population in the country is on the brink of poverty, while children are the ones who are bearing the brunt of it. The UNICEF states some 2.3 million children in Afghanistan are expected to face malnutrition in the country, while roughly 1.6 million Afghan children, some as young as 6, are trapped in child labor, working in dangerous conditions just to help their parents put food on the table.
The children pick these waste materials and sell it to me. Instead of going to school, they work to earn a bread worth. These kids are doing this job out of necessity because some of them have sick parents and take care of them, or their parents have no job and tell the children to do this for a living. They can hardly buy bread with this earning.
Mohammad Qasem, a 12-year-old worker, says he can't go to a school because he should provide bread for the family.
I am 12 years old. I pick these puddles under the scorching sun to sell and buy bread for the family with this money. I don't go to school because I work every day to earn some money. It has been 3 years that I have been doing this.
Experts believe decades of war and unrest in the country is to blame for the poverty, which is compelling families to send their loved ones on the streets to find a mouthful. But of course, the negative consequences aren't negligible.
Most of the problems in the society originate from poverty. It is due to this poverty that our children are working on the streets. But we should keep in mind that the child who is working on the street is a lost valuable asset without a bright future for the country.
U.S.-led war in Afghanistan has ruined the country's economy. It has also made Afghanistan weapons contaminated too. 134 children were killed or maimed while collecting scrap metal to sell from explosive devices between January and March of this year alone. While Afghanistan is struggling to resolve problems left behind from decades of war, many people here believe U.S. sanctions and the reduction of activities of international organizations have made the situation more complicated in the country. Abdullah Mirzada, Kabul.
And that is it for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now. Thank you.
the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willest, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Americans.
Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran,
Salam. I'm a nature enthusiast and traveler. In Close Up Iran, I introduce you to the wonders and beauties of my country, Iran. Stay with me. Places may be beautiful for their design, but sometimes they're beautiful because of their very age, because of the mark that time has left upon them. Save Jame Mosque is one of the historical, religious, and beautiful buildings where you can see traces of three historical periods: before Islam, the first centuries of the advent of Islam in Iran, and the Safavid era. Isn't that interesting? Three historical periods. So why not making a trip there? Save Jame Mosque is located in the city of Save in Markazi province, central Iran. This historical mosque is made of adobe and mud. The building of Save Jame Mosque consists of a courtyard and a dome in its southern part, two ivans, a minaret, several prayer halls or shabistans, and old mihrabs decorated and built with Kufic and Sulz scripts. The beautiful Iranian architecture, along with the handmade art of turquoise tiling of the dome, has doubled the beauty of the Save Mosque. Save Jame Mosque was registered in the National Heritage List close to 80 years ago. The mosque underwent renovation and reconstruction during various historical periods. Save is located southwest of Tehran, so I decided to drive my own car to reach this historical monument.
For the World Court's opinion on Israel's occupation of their land.
So here there is a sign which says The mosque is a few blocks away from here. And here I park my car and take a walk to the mosque. Oh, the weather is great. And all I need is just a camera to record the beautiful niches of this great mosque. Okay, I can see the single minaret of the mosque and the turquoise dome of it. You know what? The turquoise dome of this mosque has a height of 16 meters and a diameter of 14 meters. It's shining like a beautiful gem. Camera. I need my camera. Good. I'm so excited. Iranian architecture is attractive. And here I am at the wonderful courtyard of the mosque. Oh my God, look at the prayer halls. They are magnificent. Experts believe the beautiful prayer halls and corridors of the mosque with their brick facades were built during the Seljuk era. It's more like a museum. Let me take some photos. Great. Archaeological samples dating back to the pre-Islamic, early Islamic and Safavid eras have been unearthed by archaeologists conducting research on the mosque. And here I enter the mosque. Wow! The main mihrab of the mosque has vertical and horizontal inscriptions on its three walls. They are engraved with Kufi and Sulus scripts and Quranic verses. Very beautiful. God bless the archaeologists of this mosque. Jome Mosque of Save is a valuable legacy in religion, architecture, painting, tiling, and ornamentations such as plasterwork and Kufi and Sol's scripts. I prefer to talk less so that I won't lessen the beauty of this Iranian architectural masterpiece. This historical mosque attracts visitors from different Islamic countries. So, pack your suitcase and make a visit to this historical mosque, and don't forget to take a camera with yourself. Life is short, so don't miss its countless beauties.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Eye on Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Each week, we look at a trending news story which has a direct relevance to the beautiful religion of Islam, and we break it down from a Muslim perspective. A spat of Islamophobic attacks in the UK's second largest city, Birmingham, has put the spotlight once again on anti-Muslim racism in Britain. Official statistics show that Muslims are the most targeted group in this country, with nearly 3,500 hate crimes perpetrated against Muslims in England and Wales last year. So on today's show, we're going to ask why Islamophobia is reaching epidemic proportions and what can be done about it.
On the 29th of March, around 11 p.m., an elderly Muslim man walking home from his local masjid was viciously attacked by three men. The unprovoked assault left the 73-year-old victim hospitalized with a broken hand and multiple cuts to the face. The incident is just the latest example of an all-too-common event in Britain, Islamophobic hate crimes. The UK has a severe problem with anti-Muslim discrimination. Unchecked political rhetoric, combined with hostile media coverage, has created fear and mistrust, the seeds which breed hatred of the close to 4 million Muslims living in England. Right-wing terrorism poses a constant threat, with a far-right teenager found guilty of planning to murder Muslims at two mosques in England in March 2023. Unfortunately, some terrorists have been more successful, as was the case with Mohammed Salim, who was murdered in cold blood by Ukrainian neo-Nazi Pavlo Lapshin in April 2013. Another example was a terror attack near Finsbury Park Mosque in London, 2017. Islamophobe Darren Osborne drove a van into pedestrians, killing Makram Ali, again during the Islamic Holy Month. Despite these horrific murders, the UK government remains unwilling to find a working definition of Islamophobia. Critics suspect it's due to fear many of its party members would be found guilty of anti-Muslim prejudice.
Well, joining us today to talk about Islamophobia in the UK and elsewhere, we have Omar Kazmi, who is an anti-imperialist political activist who's recently finished a master's degree in human rights law. He previously worked on Jeremy Corbyn's 2016 leadership campaign and later worked in the UK Parliament. And Farah Kutena, originally from and raised in Al-Quds, from one of the last Palestinian families in the Old City. She is also the founder of Key 48, a campaign calling for the immediate right of return of all Palestinian refugees and a referendum amongst the global Palestinian community on the future of Palestine. Welcome to the show, both of you. Farah, let me come straight to you because you've been able to join me in the studio, which I appreciate. Just tell me, why are we seeing so much anti-Muslim hatred? And not only that, but it's boiling over to a proportion where people feel that it's okay to physically assault innocent Muslims in the street. Why is it getting that bad?
It's a culmination of multiple reasons. I think one of those reasons would be kind of the way in which Muslims have been depicted for the past few decades in TV series, in movies, in Hollywood, which we know has links to the CIA, kind of going along with any kind of US foreign policy that's fitting at the time. And then also we have within that culmination is British government policies, kind of prevent and other Islamophobic policies, and also kind of the attitudes of British governments at the time. You know, we know there's a rampant Islamophobia within the Conservative Party. We've had a Prime Minister, like, for example, Boris Johnson, who was extremely Islamophobic, never even really apologised, you know, let alone actually was held accountable for the Islamophobic remarks he made. And we know that there was a direct impact by those remarks. We know that his remark referring to Muslim women as letterboxes, as burglars, we know that the, you know, Islamophobic attacks on Muslim women increased by over 300% just as a direct result of that single comment he made. So it's a culmination of many factors.
Omar, you're joining us over Skype, and again, welcome to the show. Just tell me, in your opinion, who's more to blame for this atmosphere of hostility towards Muslims? Do you think that it's just politicians who are to blame, or perhaps the media has a major role in causing this problem?
Well, I think it's definitely both. I mean, the British media, which of course includes print, broadcast and radio, has played and continues to play a very, very large role in stoking Islamophobia. And I think this is a very important question because the media, by and large, is an extension of the British state. So I think there's not really that clear-cut divorce between politicians and the British media. They kind of work in tandem with each other, particularly the government of the day. And the British state, of course, has been a pioneer of 21st century Islamophobia across the globe, particularly in the post-9/11 period. There's almost no media outlet in Britain that is not, at least doctrinally, an extension of the British state. There's no countercultural newspaper, television show, or radio program, really. And all of the media news outlets have dedicated liaison on staff that report to or are directly paid by the British security services in order to produce content directly for them. And similarly, defense correspondents are essentially embedded in the Ministry of Defense, regurgitating state propaganda. And on key issues of security policy, international policy, and of course, Muslims in Britain are a highly securitized community and of special interest as well in terms of international policy, there's very little that is produced in, you know, broadcast, print, and radio that's not directly generated by the state or that leans heavily on the state for both its line and its expert contributors. So I think they kind of work in tandem with each other.
But Omar, there's also this kind of issue which is pushed. They're like conspiracy theories, misconceptions that have become quite popular in large parts of society. this idea that Muslims are the ones that are coming over here, trying to change the West, bringing their own religious practices, trying to basically a creeping Sharia. That's the idea that's being pushed around now. Do you think that there's where is this coming from? Why is this the issue that people look at Muslims with such mistrust?
I think the problem is because Britain is undergoing a huge identity crisis, and this isn't something new. This has been happening for decades. There's been a huge well of insecurity about Britishness in political discourse, and the reasons why Muslims have been attacked is because, you know, in the shadow of this declining British Empire, we've maintained our identity and they haven't, and they're confused about their identity. The decline of Christianity in particular has, I think, come as a shock to the values of society and to what people think Britain is conceptually. In the recent census, we saw that Britain really isn't any longer a Christian country. There's a huge amount of atheists and agnostic people here in Britain, but people still seem to think, well, we have our Christian cultural values, and these Muslims, these foreign barbarians, are here to subvert our, you know, the beauty of Christendom. So I think it's primarily because Brits themselves are undergoing this identity crisis.
Let me come back to you, Farah, and just ask about the Islamophobia comes in different forms. There's obviously street thugs and right-wing terrorists who commit violent acts against Muslims directly. But there's also state-backed efforts which are deemed Islamophobic, like the Prevent Countering Extremism strategy, which is basically a government-backed initiative to try and root out extremism. But there seems to be an obsession with Muslims in this policy. Just tell us a little bit about Prevent and also your own personal experiences with this strategy.
Yeah, so Prevent is, you know, a counter-terrorism strategy, a wider strategy of another policy called Contest, and it's very relevant to point out this is a policy created and formed by the Conservative Party, a right-wing party. You know, it states that it's to kind of you know, target extremism, but actually it's an attempt by a right-wing government to purge the, you know, it's left-wing citizens. And what you'll find amongst the Muslim community in the UK is that they do sit on the left. They, you know, they endorse kind of socialist policies. You know, the Muslim community really gathered behind, for example, Jeremy Corbyn in his attempts to become prime minister as well. So really they've kind of exploited Prevent to target kind of a left-wing voting base, to criminalise kind of views such as being pro-Palestine, such as, you know, so, many views, even, you know, being supportive of something like Black Lives Matter, and kind of all these views that do sit on the left of the political spectrum. And from my own personal experiences of Prevent, when I was at university, it was massively used to crush our freedom of speech, our freedom of expression, when it came to Palestine, but then also marginalising and criminalising kind of Muslim students' right to express their religion on campus. We had members of staff fulfilling their Prevent duty, which would involve them actually kind of turning Islamic prayer rooms into multi-faith rooms, destroying prayer mats, destroying Qurans as well. Oh, wow. And kind of just criminalising Muslim students on campus.
So basically, if you're a Muslim who perhaps expresses political views that you know, are not in line with how the state's worldview, pro-Palestine sentiment, for example, I think I've even read reports of students who have accidentally said, "I live in a terrorist house," and it's been misinterpreted to mean a terrorist house. Mm-hmm. Then in comes Prevent. Teachers report on students. Muslim kids are basically treated like they're criminals or terrorists.
There was one notable case of a secondary school student. He was a Muslim student. And he was simply wearing a Free Palestine badge on his school uniform. And the police raided his house because teachers then reported him to Prevent, using their Prevent duty.
Well, those are some very valid points you mentioned. But of course, Islamophobia isn't just a problem in the UK, but is prevalent in all non-Muslim nations around the world. Two particularly bad cases of state-sponsored Islamophobia can be found in India and France, as the following report explains.
The rise of nationalist politics and Hindu fundamentalism has led to the marginalisation and discrimination of Muslims in India. The ruling BJP party in particular has been accused of discriminating against Muslims. In 2019, it passed the controversial Citizenship Amendment Act, which offered citizenship to non-Muslim refugees from neighbouring countries while excluding Muslims. the law sparked widespread protests and condemnation from human rights groups and the international community. In the media, Muslims are often depicted as terrorists, criminals, and anti-national elements, which has contributed to the rise of hate crimes and vigilantism against Muslims. Muslims were also blamed for the spread of the COVID-19 virus and were subjected to discrimination and violence. Lynchings of Muslims have become more common, with mobs targeting individuals suspected of consuming or selling beef, which is considered sacred by Hindus. Muslims have also been excluded from employment opportunities and denied access to education and healthcare. Meanwhile, France has the largest Muslim population in Europe, with estimates suggesting that there are between 5 and 6 million Muslims living in the country. However, they're often subjected to discrimination, social exclusion, and hate crimes. The French government has a strict separation of church and state and has banned the wearing of religious symbols in public spaces, including the hijab, niqab, and burqa. The powerful far-right National Front Party, led by Marine Le Pen, has campaigned on an anti-immigrant and anti-Islam platform, using fear-mongering tactics to appeal to voters. The party has also been accused of promoting hate speech and inciting violence against Muslims. Daesh terror attacks in France have also contributed to Islamophobia. These attacks have led to a sense of fear and mistrust amongst the wider population, with Muslims being unfairly blamed and subjected to discrimination and hate crimes. In 2021, President Emmanuel Macron introduced a new law that aimed to combat so-called Islamist separatism and promote secularism. The law includes measures such as increasing oversight of mosques and Muslim organizations, as well as restrictions on homeschooling and the issuance of halal certificates.
So there you go, some prominent examples of blatant Islamophobia in other countries. Ammar, let me bring you back in on this. Now, of course, Islamophobia is a kind of European continent-wide epidemic and has been for quite some time. We've seen a rising trend in Quran burnings, for example, which has been defended. These are far-right protests, actions which have been defended by leaders of European countries, particularly in Scandinavia and elsewhere. And of course, in France, as we've seen, there seems to be a rise in anti-Muslim sentiment in the highest levels of political life there. Could you just tell us, are you concerned that what we're seeing in France and elsewhere could be the direction in which the UK is going in? And just how far will this go? I mean, it looks to me as if we could be returning to 1930s Europe, where minorities were put into concentration camps.
Well, I am very concerned, and certainly the example of India is very apposite in terms of what you just mentioned about the 1930s, given that the Hindutva ideology that the BJP subscribes to and the RSS movement takes great inspiration from Nazism and European race science in general. I think that, you know, as Islamophobia, as you say, is a European continent-wide phenomenon, it's also a global phenomenon. We do need to be concerned about the happenings in other countries. Of course, what's happening in those other countries isn't directly comparable. What's happening in France, for example, is very much related to the fact that it's, you know, a republic, whereas Britain's a constitutional monarchy. The republic sees itself as a vanguard that imposes its values on others. But we shouldn't ever be complacent about what happens there, because often what we see with these sorts of trends is that these tactics are almost battle-tested in one area of the world, and then they end up expanding to another. Particularly in the European continent, we've seen trends in terms of legislation and banning and the liquidation of Islamic assets happening not just in France, but in Germany, in Austria, and in other European countries. So we should never be under the illusion that we aren't rapidly heading in that direction here in Britain. It's potentially dangerous and complacent to engage in a game of kind of relativized victimhood, because that will, as you rightly mentioned, could end in, you know, a march to the death camps. Islamophobia is a global industry, a global problem, and we have to be very cautious about it in this society. Otherwise, who knows, we could be in the position of those Muslims in France or in India.
Farah, obviously there is a massive issue with this, and we could talk about different countries specifically. But one thing which I find very interesting is that there's this idea that Muslims who emigrate here and settle here, they should perhaps be grateful that they live in a country where they have perhaps a bit more freedoms than they do in countries like India, where there are purges against Muslims that take place in the streets. Not necessarily as bad as that here yet, but I think that there are some who would say to Muslims, well, you should be grateful, you should be more British as a result, you shouldn't be complaining so much. What's your response to that?
I think it's quite an outrageous, sentiment. There's nothing really that Muslims should be grateful for being here. I've witnessed my Muslim friends have female Muslim friends have had their hijabs torn off. You know, the rhetoric of Tommy Robinson has led to actions like these, and we see even just a few years ago these letters being posted around people's homes saying, you know, punish a Muslim day, and kind of offering points to harm Muslims.
Yes, those are just a few examples, but Amar, let me ask you about a specific phenomenon which has occurred recently. There's the rising Quran burnings in Europe. The reason I come back to this is because we saw a massive Muslim reaction to recent burnings which took place in Scandinavia. Turkey got involved. They boycotted or they vetoed a bid by Sweden to join NATO, and it turned into a massive political scandal. And some may argue that the Muslim reaction to that basically achieved some results. So what I want to ask you about is how Muslims should respond to incidents of Islamophobia in whatever form they take. Do you think we need more street protests? Do you think we need more Muslims in politics? What's the solution?
Well, I think that certainly we need more advocacy for Muslims, and we need more organization. I think one of the biggest reasons why Islamophobes, not just in Britain, but particularly in the Nordic countries where there are even fewer Muslims than there are, you know, in Britain and other countries, is there's a lack of an institutional, organizational defense for Muslim communities. And that, because we don't have that, it means that there's no real deterrent for these would-be attackers. And when we did have those protests, we saw that it was effective. But these broad institutional failures among Muslims globally, that is what really has emboldened these enemies of Islam and Muslims to take these sorts of actions, which of course is encouraged by the rhetoric of various governments. The problem that we have in the Muslim community, that, you know, the Jewish community, for example, doesn't have, is we don't have a sort of structure of state-funded community defense organizations like the Community Security Trust, which is a lobbying group that's funded by the British government. There's no, you know, Muslim Shomrim. There's no organized community defense force. There are no legal organizations that lobby explicitly to protect Muslim interests. It's not even necessarily about Muslims going into politics. It's about Muslims having the capacity to be able to influence political change, which doesn't necessarily need to happen by people being elected to parliament. They can become lobbyists, and they can we can develop organizations that actually have clout politically. So I think we do have to come together to protect our communal interests, because the ones that exist at the moment, organizations in Britain, for example, like Tell Mama, have been so heavily subverted, in my view, and penetrated by agents of causes that are completely hostile to Muslims. So we don't really have any real advocacy organizations.
Farah, I want to ask you the same question. What do you think the solution is? Because as we've discussed in this show, there is many different types of Islamophobia. We have entire governments that are supportive of this viewpoint. And right now in the UK, they won't even define Islamophobia. There isn't even a government-recognized definition of the term Islamophobia. So we don't even know how to combat it if we can't even define it. So what do you mean? What's the solution?
I think the solution here is to put more kind of leaders of Muslim communities in positions of power and influence. So they're, you know, they're the ones really deciding kind of what policies are Islamophobic, what policies you know, are harmful to the Muslim community. The likes of tokenism in regards to the Conservative Party, where they place these politicians who may be people of colour or maybe of a certain religion, but then still, implement the same harsh policies that their white counterparts would implement isn't good enough anymore. We actually need representation behind those kind of token figures.
I'm going to bring it to you, Amar. The same question to you. There is an issue with political representation, I think, because Hamza Youssef, the leader of the SNP now in Scotland, he's being criticised as to whether he's even a Muslim anymore because he's seen as compromising on his Islamic values to obtain that position. But what about the idea of if you are principled like Jeremy Corbyn and stand by your views, then you'll be denied the opportunity with the establishment turning on you to keep you out of positions of power. What do you think? Do you think that there's any chance of gaining any real political representation for Muslims in the West?
I do think it's very difficult if you're a practicing Muslim to become a politician of any influence in this country. And that's why now I'm primarily focusing on other ways in which we can leverage our power. And I think having, you know, strong communal organizations is one way in which Muslims can assert themselves. Because, you know, Jeremy Corbyn, for example, who was seen by the security establishment in Britain as being politically Muslim because of his proximity to Muslim communities in Britain, you know, he was, as one commentator pointed out, a victim of Islamophobia in and of himself, and he wasn't even a Muslim. And you can see the way in which Muslims are attacked because the aim of these individuals, people like Keir Starmer, for example, who are servants of the security establishment, is they want to, and they're being quite successful, actually, in ejecting Muslims from public life. And they're doing that at the behest of not only the security state here in Britain, but also at the behest of Zionist entryists who represent the interests of a hostile foreign regime. So my view is, our The current political situation is very difficult to be a